But there's nothing magical about vinyl. In fact, vinyl's a pretty poor way of reproducing sound in technically. There's a hell of a lot of stuff going on in there that people don't really realize. So it makes actually makes little sense to be very anal about vinyl reproduction systems.
Hello, welcome to Not an Audiophile, episode 14, season 1. Today we're back with David Spargo, a famed acoustician and recording engineer, well, more of a mastering engineer, but also someone with a vast knowledge of all things audio and acoustics. And today we discuss just that. And but you know, so your grounding in acoustics was led to some degree by Neville Teal. So that's something you'd put on your CV, obviously, pretty proudly. And but you spent many years experimenting, doing a bit of research. What's your sort of what was?
Yeah, I did. I did a lot of research. I've published a bit.
Yep.
My main research area was in cognitive acoustics,
mm-hmm.
which encompasses, well, essentially it's how we think we hear things.
Mm-hmm.
My particular area was in sound source location or low frequency sound source location in rooms.
Okay.
Which is quite an interesting problem. Because often we think, often the place we think the sound is coming from is not where it's coming from.
The lower the frequency is harder to locate, is that, or not necessarily?
Yeah, look, it can be. A lot of people think you can't locate low frequency, but that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the room has a big effect on where you think it's coming from. So,
yep.
Just depends on things like the pressure difference between the ears. And when you've got strong room modes occurring in a room, then the pressure differential can be quite great between the ears.
Oh, between so that, left and right ear.
Yeah.
Or front and rear ear if you're from Tasmania. between your two ears, so to speak. Yeah, the fact that one, that they're receiving different pressures. If you're on the verge of standing on a node or...
And there's lots of things that the auditory system is monitoring,
mm-hmm.
in terms of the sound that is presented at the ears, so it's constantly comparing timing information, level information, spectral information.
Mm-hmm.
All of that. So I studied all of that.
Okay. I've got
all of the science around that.
I've got a question that's maybe related to that, and you may or may not be able or wish to answer it. But so a lot of people say that you can't get good sound at a hi-fi show, and I guess there's reasons for that. The room acoustics are not ideal, and it's a pretty noisy environment, and that doesn't help, I suppose, but as far as achieving great or impressive sound. But I also feel there's a thing, for instance, I can walk around a show and go, I love that room, I love this room, and then the other person I'm having lunch with says, oh, no, that room was dreadful, I like this room and that room. And you hated those rooms, you found them to be awful in every way or whatever. Now, is this because our systems at home or whatever system we listen to the most are quite different, or our tastes different, our ears are different? What I mean, I have a theory that if you're used to the way your system sounds, you're kind of adjusted to that. You then go to the hi-fi show. Therefore, rooms that have a similar balance to what you have at home will be the ones that appeal most to you. Is that a thing, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a fair kind of assumption. The thing with all sensory perception is that we don't ever really perceive, you know, what we consider to be reality directly.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing is, you know, everybody has an internal model of reality that's built up from years of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that we base our perception on. We're not experiencing everything directly because our sensory system is busy filtering, you know, data, doing data reduction, for example, because we couldn't possibly cope with all of the sensory input that our bodies collect.
No.
So we have to filter all of that and just present, you know, hopefully important information, yeah. And then we fill in the gaps based on our experience.
Yeah. So does that throw subjective auditioning and reviewing of hi-fi into some question in some ways?
Well, yes, in a way it does, because everybody's model of reality is different.
Mm.
Because everyone has different accumulated experience. Plus just simple things like the shape of your ears and the shape of your head.
Mm-hmm. Well, the shape of some audiophile's head is clearly a handicap as far as...
That changes.
Just jokes.
That just simply changes the way we hear things as well. So, plus we have other complicating factors like preferences,
mm-hmm.
which might be based on experience, or they might be based on some other kind of choice. So, yes, I think you know, part of that assumption that you're making, or that the theory that you're making, is that, yeah, certain people have certain preferences for different types of sound or different types of environments. And they're not necessarily, you know, better or worse than other people's. They're just different.
Yeah, I suppose when you think about it, it would be, in the chaotic nature of life, it would be impossible, or it would be highly unlikely, that every single person at a hi-fi show would agree which was the best room, which was the best sound, because that would be ridiculous. It would be, I mean, that would be amazing considering how chaotic everything else is in both relation to humans and the planet, I guess. But in
carefully designed perceptual experiments, you can isolate a lot of those biases.
Okay.
But it's very complicated creating perceptual experiments, and it's quite tedious to participate in them as well.
Sure.
So a lot of it doesn't get done, particularly in the hi-fi world.
Yeah.
A lot of perceptual experimentation that could be done.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't get done, potentially because it's very difficult and it takes a lot of resources to sort of get around those difficulties.
Yeah.
But also because I don't think people really want to know.
there's a possibility of that, yeah.
I don't want to know why these speakers sound better than these ones, you know.
Yeah, I guess that's where Floyd Toole comes in. He's done a lot of study about what humans prefer, the sound balance, or, you know, the various qualities.
He's a recognized, you know, world expert in this area, but of course he's always worked in the American audio industry.
Mm-hmm.
Worked for JBL for a long time.
Yep.
So he has certain biases in as well. Not I'm saying that, you know, there's anything wrong with the work that he does, but you know, everybody has biases in the way they approach things.
Yeah.
So you know, and because a lot of his research came out of commercial research, there are certain biases that go with that.
Yeah, well, that's right. I guess he's been sponsored by, I mean, most of his studies on that, I think, was when he was working for Harman, so...
Yeah.
You know. Although, didn't he work... But did he not work in Canada.
Yeah, I think he's a Canadian.
I mean, don't get me wrong. He's a very good researcher, and you know, he's certainly one of the, you know, the most influential researchers that I've come across in my field. So, you know,
I feel as if you may have a slight underlying concern, though, but is that just because he's sort of slightly commercially tainted? Is that, you know, in some of his research, perhaps, or do you just not like some of his outcomes? Or not agree with them, not like them, just feel differently about some of the thoughts.
Hello.
Yeah, we've lost.
David, are you there? Can you hear?
Oh, I'm back. Sorry.
Oh, you're back. Okay.
Sorry, can you just ask that question again? I lost you for a minute.
No, that's all right, David. Yeah, basically I think what I was saying is you seem to have an underlying you have a thought on his research.
Reservation?
Yeah, maybe a reservation. Thank you, Brad. Reservation or... And is that because of his potentially... His thoughts being slightly coloured from commercial involvement, or is it that there's something that you just found to be different to what he's uncovered in his research?
No, I didn't sort of mean to give an impression that I sort of questioned him at all.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
I think the underlying issue here is that whenever you're researching perceptual or cognitive responses to things which have a strong aesthetic component, it's a completely fraught area. So you have to be incredibly careful about isolating any potential biases or external influences.
Mm.
So I don't know. I don't know what. I probably can't express exactly what I meant before, but
well, I mean, you by that statement, you're implying that did the audience that or the test subjects that he was using, did they have visual clues about something that you're? Cause, I mean, you're implying that you.
Oh no, but you know, if you're doing research in a commercial environment, so you're trying to develop a commercial loudspeaker,
yeah.
Usually the participants that you have, if you create a listening test for something, usually the participants will have some kind of vested interest, because they might be employees, you know, of the same company.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's, you know, any loudspeaker manufacturer has the potential for that to occur. So you have, you know, and maybe these are the best listeners in the world, but, you know, they still have a...
Everyone's got a bias.
I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with what Floyd Toole has done over the years. I didn't mean to imply that there was, but just for context, then a lot of his research was done in a commercial space.
We can always edit this and tighten it up and get rid of the suggestion that you thought that his
work was a load of bollocks. Yeah, I really didn't mean to suggest that it was
no,
because anything untoward going on
there. But there is people who don't entirely. I mean, I find his work to be quite. I love the idea that we can have a fairly straightforward explanation about why some people prefer the sound of one loudspeaker to another. Life would be a hell of a lot simpler if it was that simple. But it worries me that I'm losing my hearing, because I walk around hi-fi shows quite often disagreeing with other people who are also experienced listeners. I mean, for instance, Brad. I mean, I don't think I've ever done this, walked around a show with Brad and made notes about which rooms we prefer, but it's highly likely that we're going to prefer different rooms, because I know that our tastes are probably slightly different. But why are our tastes different? Is it because we have a preference, or is it because we're used to listening to a different system, or is it just a combination of those things?
Well, I think our preferences are driven by what we're used to.
Mm-hmm.
To a large degree.
Well, it goes back to that MP3 comparison.
Well, yeah, I guess
yeah,
so.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Versus vinyl or whatever it was, analog.
Yeah, I mean, you know, vinyl certainly sounds different to CD. And there's a lot of romanticising that goes on with vinyl, which colours people's opinions about it. I'm not saying that, you know, one's necessarily better than the other, but there's nothing magical about vinyl. In fact, vinyl's a pretty poor way of reproducing sound. There's a hell of a lot of stuff going on in there that people don't really realize. So it actually makes little sense to be very anal about vinyl reproduction systems. I mean, even simple things like the RIAA curve that's used, you know, in both ways, is not particularly well defined.
It has moved over the years, I believe.
Yeah, we can have variation. You can have variations on the theme, can't you?
Did we just lose someone?
I think David's out.
Consequently.
Oh, no, David's still there. Yeah, don't know what the hell the beat was. Yep.
We just lost David momentarily.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. I got a call coming in.
Oh, yeah, no, that's just... Oh, do you need to take it, or... You...
No, okay. Sorry. So,
Yeah, the RIAA curve.
When people make... RIAA equalizers, the variation is actually quite wide.
Mm.
So it kind of makes no sense, really, to be very particular about that system, because it could be anything, almost. You only need something that's close to the response, and then it will sound all right.
Right.
Because you don't know, for example, nobody knows what the RIAA curve was that the vinyl was mastered with.
Yes, yeah.
All right. So if you're spending, you know, a huge amount of effort to try and get a, you know, incredibly accurate RIAA playback equalizer, it might be nothing like the one that was used to encode the audio in the first place.
Yeah, you're right. Records like prehistoric in a way, but they can sound amazingly good at times. But I do wonder.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. And I really don't want to, you know, I don't mean to detract from the overall satisfaction of listening to a vinyl record, because I still think they sound great too.
Yeah.
And well, look, the point that I was trying to make about the RIAA curve was that there are lots of ways to interpret that. The description for those EQ curves, and there are lots of ways of building those filters and things, and they all sound different to each other.
Mm.
Plus the fact that the cutting lathes have, I mean, although they're very good, they're figures for like rumble and wow and things like that are often not as good as some of the turntables that you're playing records on. So it sort of begs the question, how good do turntables and reproduction systems really need to be? And I think, you know, if you've got a turntable that has a much lower rumble figure, for example, than a cutting lathe, then you're probably wasting a bit of money there.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the hi-fi biz, isn't it? I mean, it's what people feel they need or what they want to have, and it's not always sensible, I guess.
No, it's not always sensible, yeah.
But then, you know, people buy Ferraris and then just drive them around town at 60 or 80 kilometres an hour, which seems...
Or leave them sitting in a garage.
Well, even worse, that's right, yeah. Look, I reckon we have covered a lot of ground. Brad's tired. He's starting to confuse his I's with his R's, and which is understandable.
Oh Jesus! You're cutting that bit out, for God's sake. R-I-double-A.
According to my better half Sharon, who was listening to an episode the other day to transcribe or pick or correct the transcription or something, she said that. I told you, Brad, when you said just cut that out, that I said that we don't have the technology. So we probably do, but, you know. I'm a great believer in, you know, just making it real. So
yeah, raw like a pineapple. Great, Andrew. I can feel it right now as it enters my...
No. I'll remove all references to the IRAA curve.
You bastard. Okay, fair cop.
I think we're going
to
get...
David, I just want... Before we go, and it's a question Andrew seems to like to ask because he never normally asks, hey, where did we meet, David, when we sort of cast our eyes across the sort of...
smoke-filled
I think
room.
We met in your shop in Leichhardt when you were... When you had that shop in Leichhardt.
Ah, now, I do remember. We don't have to have this in, Andrew. I can remember you... looking in the window because we were doing the...
Here we go. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we had a little shop, Andrew, that was part of the Leichhardt Council's Renew Leichhardt.
Oh, yeah.
Because Leichhardt at Norton Street had sort of basically become sort of a cultural desert. Mm-hmm. And they were getting the odd landlord to, you know, lease their property for $100 or $150 a week.
Yep.
So there was...
So there was something going on.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. And so we had to festoon the front window with bits of audio equipment and it was an attractor to pull people in.
Yep.
And I was in that little front room area. We had an upstairs section where we did a lot of listening tests or demos and downstairs with sort of, we had sort of a I think we had a whole lot of album covers up on the wall and et cetera and a system in the window. And David sort of, well, now I do remember, your eyes glanced up as I furtively looked out the window.
Yeah, I was walking up the road and I saw a loudspeaker and I went, oh, can't go past a shop with a loudspeaker in the window.
Certainly not.
And David likes a nice cup of coffee, Andrew.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history, yeah.
And what was that... Did that shop have a title, Brad, or what was the – like, did it have a sign hanging out, a shingle?
Oh, yes. I think we might have – that's when we were Brigadier's Audio.
Oh, okay.
Yes, yeah.
And but it should have been called the Sonic Bartery or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. We just had Brigadier's Audio, and we shared the space with a creative writer, Bernard Curran.
Mm-hmm.
And also we shared the space with a lady that was teaching art at an art college thing, so she would put art presentations on.
Okay.
So we had to share the space, and there was another lady, and then it was a bit like Survivor, where gradually people got the shits with, you know, and left.
So there were various tests and what have you, and as people failed,
they got expelled.
They got expelled. Brad expelled them.
No. I'm still Facebook friends with the all three of them.
Okay.
So,
well, we know that's a true definition of friendship. So,
that's a great sign, isn't it? Not that I ever post on Facebook, but definitely we survived that, and And but it was a good experiment. It was what was really the real true value of that particular place was meeting David Spiger. That was the
one
good thing.
I have a sneaking suspicion that the first conversation went for many hours. So
It did actually.
I think it did. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. David, have you got any closing remarks or? Is there anything you really want to tell the audio world, the great, almost said unwashed audio enthusiasts? But I don't mean that. What I mean is those that are eager for information, eager for a trinket of a jewel of inside information. Have you got something to offer? I know I'm putting you on the spot, so feel free to say no.
I think that in terms of listening conditions, I think, good listening rooms are always going to give much greater pleasure than just spending lots of money on audio equipment.
Mm-hmm.
I think, a good listener, you can get really good results out of quite a modest equipment investment in a good room, whereas it's much more difficult to work the other way around. So, the most expensive gear in the world is not going to sound great in a bad room.
No. And yet you see pictures on Instagram daily that where they've attempted to do just that.
I've gone into plenty of people's rooms over the years and just, and like I said, some of them with quite modest systems that just are really enjoyable and sound great. And others you go into and you just go, this sounds terrible and you are insane. There's $500,000 worth of gear in here.
Yep.
And you cannot hear what's going on.
No. That's kind of sad in a way.
And you've been asked into their rooms, David, to make an assessment.
Some people, there's all types of people, but some people who like to spend a lot of money on hi-fi just want affirmation.
Mm-hmm.
So they like to get experts in to come and tell them how fantastic their system is.
That's that never goes well, does it?
No, and I just find that a little.
Right,
I understand why people feel they need to do that, but I'm always surprised when that happens.
Yeah, but you still go out there. Is that
still? I'm not. I try not to be confrontational about these things.
No, you're not. You're a gentleman.
But it really surprises me sometimes people's attitude towards what they're doing with their sound systems. And it's really up to everybody individually what they want to do with their money. But some of it just defies logic.
Yeah. Actually, there's a quick story, Andrew, where David, and David can take the story over, but where David asked me to come along and do some listening or evaluation in a room that he'd sort of specced, I think, for this customer. And the guy had pretty expensive gear, but it didn't sound right before the room had been fixed up. And but this particular fellow sort of let David loose, so to speak. So do you remember that one looking over Pittwater almost 3 years ago?
Somebody approached me. They were building a new house, mm-hmm. and they heard about what I did, and they it explained to me that they had a reasonable sound system, and they were really into music, and they wanted they wanted wanted to set it up in a room, and they wanted it to sound good. And they asked me to do an acoustic shelf of some sort, because they wanted a multimedia kind of area. And I said, "Oh, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. Why don't you send me?" So I established that they were still at the architects. So I was still doing drawings. They hadn't started building. And I said, "Well, why don't you send me over the drawings so that I could have a look at what you're planning?"
Yep.
And he did. And when I got a look at them, I thought, "Oh, this is going to be terrible." I looked at what they were proposing for this big living room area that they were building, and where he wanted to set up the sound system, and it was a cathedral basically, with a living room at one end and a kitchen at the other, and it was all hard surfaces. So it was stone floors, glass walls, gyprock ceiling.
Wow.
And it was a huge space. And so I rang this guy back and said, "Look, I understand now what you're talking about with the acoustic cabinet, but," I said, "you've got much bigger problems than that. You are going to have much bigger problems than that."
Mm-hmm.
"You're not going to be able to live in this space because it's just going to be so noisy and reverberant." And so he kind of, to his credit, he went, "Oh, okay, so what should I do?" And I designed acoustic treatment for that room,
mm-hmm.
which was all integrated, highly integrated. So there was a ceiling that went in, an acoustic ceiling with a tuned absorption.
Yes.
Really looked nice too. Looked good as well.
And because one of the things I do in my acoustic work is that I'm really concerned about the way things look at the end of the day.
Mm.
I want them to sound great, but I want them to look great as well. And I really don't want rooms to look like they've got acoustic treatment in them.
Yeah.
Because I find that kind of annoying myself.
Mm.
So anyway, he took all the advice on board. It was, even though it was going to cost him considerably more to do it than he was originally planning, he still took it on board and built the room, and it sounded great. And he still got his glass windows and stone floor and everything, but it just sounded great. And
he got his acoustic curtains where the glass, the long glass wall was. You had some acoustic blinds? Well, use the
no, I don't. Acoustic blinds. I don't think we did do that. It was mostly in the ceiling that we did the treatment. I can't remember. He did have some curtains of some description. But when I went over there after he'd set it all up, I just wasn't really that impressed with the way it sounded, and I thought, better get Brad to come and have a look at this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, whenever you start moving loudspeakers around, you need a couple of people there to work with it. So
yep.
We spent maybe, I don't know, it was about an hour.
Yeah,
about an moving, hour. Moving hour and the half. Speakers around, and then just found the right combination, and the whole system just sprang to life, and it was like, you know, that hair standing up on the back of your neck feeling.
Yeah.
Where it was just perfect, and we were like,
yeah,
whoa. So then we spent like 2 or 3 hours just sitting there listening to stuff because it just sounded so good.
The moral of the story is that you have to get the acoustics right, but then you still have to install the equipment in the correct positions, I guess.
Yeah, it's a system. The whole thing is a system.
Yeah.
You have to address everything in the system.
Which kind of reminds me of a story, I think. You told me, David. It was where a guy rang you up and said, my system sounds like crap. I've spent all this money, blah, 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 you know. And you said, I'm not going to fix it over the phone for you, but why don't you send me some pictures and a plan or something?
Yeah. Well, he was remote, so there was no chance.
Yeah, you weren't going to be able to visit, yes.
No. And I said, well, look, just send me a couple of photographs And if you would do some measurements in the room to tell me where the loudspeakers are and where your listening position is.
Yep.
And what the dimensions of the room is. So he did that. And I, as soon as I saw it, I went, oh. He also described to me what he was hearing in the room, because that's one of the things I do first, is I get people to tell me what's their impression of what's wrong. What is it that they're unsatisfied with? Because it gives me a really good idea of what they're keyed into in terms of the way they're hearing the rooms. And I, as soon as I looked at his drawing, I could see really clearly what was going on, especially as it related to what he thought the fault was in the room. And so I just emailed him back and said, just move your left speaker, you know, 300 millimetres to the right and 100 millimetres forward, and just a few other adjustments like that.
Yes, and pretty simple little tweaks.
Simple stuff. And I didn't hear from him.
Okay.
So it just went, and I went, well, okay, maybe it didn't work. And then about 6 months later, I got a phone call from him. I knew it was him because his name was in my phone. But as soon as I answered the phone, he was just going, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
He was a religious
man. What did you do? And I went, what?
What?
And he said, I thought you were taking the piss.
Yes, move it 276 millimetres to the right.
He said, I thought you were taking the piss. He said, I didn't do what you told me to do. And he said, over the last 6 months, I'd just become so upset with the way the loudspeakers sounded. I was just selling them. I was just about to sell them. And he said, I was just about to pack them up. And I thought, what the hell, I'll just try it.
Okay.
And he said, it totally transformed his system. He said, as soon as he did it, it was just like he was just dumbstruck. And he said he had to run up the road to his mate, who was also into audio, and grab him down and get him to have a listen. And they were just like, both of them were just astounded at how different his system sounded. And it solved the problem that he was hearing. So he didn't end up.
So he hung on to them, I guess.
Yeah. He said he was perfect.
So what,
perfectly satisfied.
So for the sake of the audience, do you remember what, you know, 300 mil, 100 mil, and I guess you're using those as example tweaks, because what your point is that that very little was wrong with the system. The gear was good. The room was basically okay.
Yeah, the gear was good.
But it was in the wrong spots.
That's right. It was clear to me from the diagram that he sent me that he was driving into one or two room modes.
Yes, yeah.
And so I just got him to change the geometry a little bit so that he wasn't interacting with the room modes so strongly.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of offset, so I made the arrangement a little bit asymmetrical.
Yes.
And it just essentially just cured the problem that he was having.
Mm.
And he was
very
dumbfounded.
Very
he just couldn't understand it.
It's not anything to do with acoustics, but I do love the fact that he thought you'd taken the piss, and he just, that acoustics guy, fuck him, basically. Yeah. And
how could that possibly work?
As if that would fix anything or change anything, and just ignored it. I mean, I've got the speakers in my equilateral triangle, you know.
That's right. And people, you know, getting back to the point that we mentioned, you know, much earlier on, is that people love to have these simple answers for complex problems. And, you know, that's all the way. Look, I've set up my speakers with the equilateral triangle and it doesn't sound right.
Mm.
And I've often been to people's places that, and I say, well, let's change that. And they're like, no, you can't. It's not the right way to do it.
Mm.
You know, and it's like, I don't think you're getting it here. It's like, it's not, this is not a hard and fast rule. And it really only came from that early experimental work where, you know, that just happened to be the relationship and everyone's just gone, well, yeah, let's just not change that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no good reason for it. I mean, it does tend to work in ideal situations, particularly if you've gotten very low energy lateral reflections or late lateral reflections.
Mm. Yes, yeah.
So in a virtually anechoic environment, it does tend to work that way.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, when Blumlein was developing this system, he was in a theatre.
In a big space, yeah.
With very, very late lateral reflections or very, you know, low-level lateral reflections. So he was almost in an anechoic environment.
Mm. Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Yes, if you're putting a stereo outside, you could definitely have an equilateral triangle and you would get your best stereo,
you'd get most a pretty even good stereo image. Representation,
yeah.
But as soon as you include any room reflections, it all goes out the window.
Mm. Yeah, the best room is no room, clearly.
Correct.
Although it's not, because you want that ambience. You want that sense of space.
You still
or something.
Need the envelopment.
Envelopment, yes, that's the word.
Otherwise, your listening position becomes very, very small. Mm. The tolerance for your listening position becomes very small.
Oh, okay. So if you set up your stereo outside in a big open, like in a football field, and you get your equilateral triangle, you're only going to have one chair and you're going to need a head clamp. Is that the...
That's right.
Yeah, okay. All right, interesting. Okay, so yeah, so that diffuse sound field helps with broadening the hot spot or the sweet spot.
That's right. Mm. That's right.
And on that note, for this round of David Sparko tells us, David Sparko, the guy that invented race suits, David Spargo, the other guy who knows about acoustics, where he answers all of your questions that you haven't asked. This round is complete. David, if we asked nicely, could we get you back sometime in the future? Because what we'll do is we'll take questions. People will comment. People will ask questions. They'll have questions because you've just created that by mentioning you could move at 276 millimeters in one direction. People will have questions, and maybe we could get you back to answer. I know you're a busy man.
Be happy to.
Oh, that'd be great. Thank you so much. So thank you, David. Thank you, Brad, of course, for asking the hard questions and, of course, confusing us all about RIAA.
Let me say it for you, mate. RIAA.
Oh, he's come back. He's on top. He's had a coffee.
Yep.
And he's with us.
And you'll be cutting out those pieces anyway, so thanks for that.
Right. I'm going to cut those pieces out, even though we don't have the technology. Yeah. Yes, okay.
Yeah. And, David, thank you so much for your time.
That's all right. That's a pleasure.
Bloody marvellous, mate.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for listening. And, as you know, we would absolutely love you to subscribe, follow, like, and comment. Comments, as I say, YouTube's the best place to do that. Just do it, and we'll say whatever you like, and we'll get back to you. All right, we'll be off, and we'll be back with another episode in due course. Thank you, everybody. Bye.